From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, what it's like to be a young soldier in the Army, learn to carry a gun, and make split-second decisions about whether to pull the trigger. We talk with Christian Baumann about his new autobiographical novel, The Ice Beneath You. It's about a young man who enlists in the Army after watching the Gulf War on CNN and does a tour of duty in Somalia. Also, TV critic David Bianculli considers the glut of reality shows, and rock critic Ken Tucker reviews The Headphone Masterpiece, a new CD by Cody Chestnut. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Abortion rights advocates and abortion opponents are clashing right now in front of the U.S. Supreme Court. The abortion rights supporters arrived first, holding a candlelight vigil to mark the 30th anniversary of Roe v. Wade, the Supreme Court decision that legalized abortion in the United States. NPR's Andrea Seabrook says anti-abortion protesters arrived on the scene soon after and got into a shouting and shoving match.
Several hundred protesters down here. The two streams of protesters seem to have converged into each other, and we have two groups screaming at each other. You may be able to hear behind me, "We won't go back," from the abortion rights side, and the anti-abortion protesters are yelling, "Abortion is murder," and they're kind of shoving against each other and yelling and screaming and waving signs in each other's faces here in front of the Supreme Court.
NPR's Andrea Seabrook. Today's clashes come after a day of demonstrations in sub-zero weather. President Bush visited St. Louis today to promote his $674 billion tax cut plan. The president told workers at a trucking company that his plan would benefit small businesses and put money in the pockets of the people. Democrats in Congress and consumer groups say the Bush plan would mainly benefit the rich without doing much to stimulate the economy. The president dismissed those criticisms as what he called typical class warfare rhetoric. The Bush plan would eliminate the taxes investors pay on dividends and provide an extra $400 per child in the tax credit for families with children. The United States is disputing Iraq's claim today that it shot down an unmanned U.S. spy plane. White House and Pentagon officials say there's no truth in a statement that an Iraqi anti-aircraft unit destroyed a Predator aircraft as it conducted surveillance over Iraq. NPR's Tom Gelton reports from the Pentagon.
The unmanned Predator aircraft are relatively slow, cruising at about 85 miles per hour, so they're not that hard to shoot down. Iraqi forces destroyed one in December with what military officials at the time called a lucky shot. Now the Iraqis say they've done it again, and Iraqi television is showing footage of what appears to be airplane wreckage in the desert. But U.S. officials insist there is no truth to the Iraqi claim. Officials at the U.S. Central Command, responsible for military operations in the Middle East, say no aircraft have been reported missing. Ari Fleischer, the White House press secretary, said the Iraqi claim is an example of Saddam Hussein lying to the Iraqi people and the world. Iraqi forces regularly fire on U.S. aircraft, enforcing the so-called no-fly zones in Iraq. Tom Gelton, NPR News, the Pentagon.
In stocks today, the Dow lost 124 points, or 1.5%, to close at 8,318 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq lost 4 points. This is NPR News. West Coast dock workers have overwhelmingly approved a new contract, ending the long dispute that shut down more than 20 ports last fall. The six-year agreement was accepted by nearly 90% of the union members who voted. The pact includes a salary increase, fully paid health insurance, and a boost in pensions in exchange for the union's acceptance of computerized cargo handling systems. The Canadian government has announced a plan to boost security and surveillance at coastal ports. Karen Kelly has more from Ottawa.
An estimated 500,000 container ships dock at the Halifax port on Canada's Atlantic coast every year. Only 3% of those containers are inspected. That's raised concerns that terrorists could use ships to sneak into North America or to transport bombs. In response, the Canadian government says it's spending more than $100 million U.S. over the next 5 years to protect its coasts. The plan includes a long-range tracking system for vessels that enter Canadian waters, equipment that detects radiation, and rigorous screening of port employees. Many of the ships that dock in Canada are destined for U.S. ports. For NPR News, I'm Karen Kelly in Ottawa.
Saudi border guards have reportedly arrested a Kuwaiti man suspected in the attack that killed one American and wounded another yesterday in Kuwait. The state-run Saudi news agency said the man was arrested as he tried to cross from Kuwait into Saudi Arabia. So far, there's been no comment from Kuwaiti officials. A gunman ambushed the two American civilians yesterday near Camp Doha, the main U.S. military base in Kuwait. The wounded man is in stable condition at a hospital in Kuwait City. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Enterprise Florida, the Economic Development Partnership for Florida, helping grow Florida's innovation economy, on the web at eflorida.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Christian Bauman, has written a novel about what it's like to be a soldier, called The Ice Beneath You. It's based on his experiences enlisting after the Gulf War, then serving on U.S. Army boats with tours of duty in Somalia and Haiti. He describes the humiliations of basic training, what it's like to learn to carry a gun and to make split-second decisions about whether to pull the trigger, the difficulty of distinguishing between the people you're protecting and the ones you're fighting. And he writes about relationships in the military, friendships and romances. The action shifts between the main character's service in the military and his return to civilian life when he has trouble finding a place for himself and is haunted by an incident in Somalia he was responsible for. Since leaving the Army, Christian Bauman has worked as a cook, painter, clerk, and editor. He's also toured the country playing folk music. The Ice Beneath You is his first book. Let's start with a short reading.
I quit my job the day the 100-hour war started. I remember sitting in the Holiday Inn's break room in Cook Whites and Timberlands, nursing my coffee, transfixed by what was happening on the TV screen in front of me. The head chef walked in, walked back out, then walked back in. He looked at me, twisting the ends of his mustache. He said, "Jones, if you're not back at the salad station in 1 minute, you can kiss your employment goodbye." Then he walked back out again. I remember sitting there, still watching CNN. When a commercial finally came on, I stood, lit a cigarette, dug my keys from my pocket, and went home. I spent the next 3 days on the couch, not moving, just watching the live feeds from the Persian Gulf, watching it all unfold in front of me. I enlisted 3 months later, about the time they started sending the troops home. The recruiter said my scores were high, and I could pretty much have any job I wanted. When the options came across the computer screen, he tapped his finger on the third one down. "Boats," he said. "Army's got boats. I seen 'em down in Virginia. Take that one. Slack life." I did, and he said I wouldn't regret it. He also said I wouldn't ship out until October or November. I said that was unfortunate, but fine. I borrowed his pen and, without looking up, signed the contract for U.S. Army E-1 88 Lima 10 Waterborne Private Benjamin F. Jones. I sat back, waiting to feel different, waiting to feel something. Nothing came. That was fine, too. I shook the recruiter's sweaty hand and walked home. I didn't see the need to get another job to fill the intervening months. My three memories of that summer are the unchanging look of disgust on my wife's face, the unchanging scenes of smoke and destruction broadcast from Iraq, and the unchanging, nagging feeling I was missing out on something, something important, something necessary. I turned 21. I got two cards in the mail. One from my mother, instructing me to trust in Jesus, and one from my recruiter, instructing me to start doing push-ups.
This is Christian Bauman, reading from his new novel, The Ice Beneath You. Christian, why did you enlist in the Army?
Oh, that's such a complicated question. The easy answer is that I was young and poor with a family to support, and there were not a lot of jobs in the greater Philadelphia, New Jersey area for uneducated, poor young guys at the time. And the few jobs there were, I had pretty much worked my way through all of them. Also, my daughter, who was two at the time, I think, two or three, needed an operation. And the recruiter who I'd been sort of flirting with for a number of months said, "Oh, you know, we'll pay for that." And that was really the deal clincher for me. The real truth is it was something I had been looking at, I think, a lot longer than anyone knew, maybe even myself. When I joined, it seemed to be a very large surprise to people who knew me and to my family. Bauman was the last guy who would join the Army. And the funny thing was, is I never really saw it that way.
Did you see the Army as a way out, which your character seems to?
I had a number of I definitely wanted a way out. I mean, I was in a marriage that was not working out. I was in a place where I did not want to be. But at the same time, it was very, very important to me. I came from, I was the product of a broken marriage, and it was very, very important to me that I support my child and what needed to happen in that regard with her. So there was a little bit of escape. There was a little bit of it needed to happen. There was also this thing of, I need to take care of my family. And by being in the Army, this will force me to get out of bed in the morning and go to work because I won't have any choice in the matter.
In your novel, the recruiting sergeant suggests try boats. Were you on a boat?
I was on a boat, and it kind of happened in the way I described it. I didn't plan on that. It wasn't something I found out about to the last minute. The Army boat field is so small that recruiters never even mention it as an option. I mean, there's only at the time that I was in, there's only 2,000 guys active duty who do this. It's such a small field. So what happens is you kind of pick the things that you think you want to do, and then you go in on your actual day of enlistment to what they call the MEP station, and you sit down, and there's a computer, and on the computer screen come the jobs that are available that day. This is what we've got. And hopefully you've done your research and you can go, oh, I want to do that. And they say, okay, and then that's your job. And the jobs were coming down the screen, and I saw a couple that I thought I wanted to do. And as what happens in the book, my recruiter said, I'm going to take that one right there. I wouldn't steer you wrong. That's the one you want. And I trusted him, even though I hadn't heard of it before.
Now, your character isn't very fit when he joins the Army, and he's pretty confident that he'll fail to be able to perform the minimum number of push-ups required for basic training. He's got skinny arms. Did you have problems like that?
I had fears. it's a very scary thing going to basic training. I can't remember ever being so afraid of something. I was not so afraid going to Somalia. I was not so afraid going to Haiti. Later, I was terrified to go to basic training, which makes sense. I mean, I was 20, born in 1970, and I saw a Full Metal Jacket. I know what basic training was like, and I was scared. And so I had fears that I was not going to be able to cut it. And that's actually what propelled me through it, what forced me to get through it.
Did your drill sergeant toy with your self-esteem, and what was the impact of that?
Yes, they do, and sometimes as obvious as you would imagine from watching the movies, and sometimes not. I was okay with that. I was a little bit older than your average recruit. I was 21, which sounds like nothing, but when you're in the Army, it's a big difference. There's a big difference between 19 and 21, and my recruiter had prepared me fairly well. He had kind of told me what it was, and basically what he told me was, it is just a mind game. They're going to be right in your face, and they're going to be yelling at you. Just ignore it. Don't worry about it, and, it'll all go away. And so that's what I did.
Your character writes, I was brought up in the New Jersey suburbs. I'd never fired a gun in my life. Our first day at the range with an M16 rifle was a lesson in sheer humiliation. What was hard about learning to fire an M16?
Well, you don't think much about shooting to someone who's never done it before. You read books and they pull out a gun and they shoot, or you watch a movie or you watch TV, they pull out a gun and they shoot. And I never really gave it much thought. And so they gave me my M16 and I laid down and I shot, and it didn't go anywhere near where it was supposed to go. And that didn't make any sense to me. A lot of the guys, it went exactly where they wanted it to go. And I said, oh, geez, there's something wrong with me. There wasn't. I had just never shot before. I got there.
How long did it take before you felt comfortable with a gun?
I felt very comfortable, and if it's possible to feel very comfortable and uncomfortable at the same time. There were times where I felt like I knew exactly what I was doing with this thing, but I didn't want to have to be the one who might have to do it, if you know what I mean. I got comfortable with my ability to shoot it, and I never got comfortable with the thought that I would have to shoot it.
And did you have to shoot it?
No, no.
That's amazing. You went through Somalia and Haiti without ever having to shoot your gun.
Yeah, I think it's... I'm very fortunate.
Ever come close?
Yes, yes.
Tell me one of those stories.
Yes, there was a time we took two Army mic boats. Mic boats are LCMs. They're the landing craft, basically is what they are. But we filled their well decks with grain, and we had a nurse, medicine, and a platoon of Belgian infantry. And we were going to a village to make a delivery, I guess, for the UN. And we were supposed to go in and come back out, and we ended up having to spend the night kind of anchored off of this village. And it was tense at the time. It was at a time in Somalia. This was almost a year before the incident described in Black Hawk Down, almost a year before the Battle of Mogadishu. There was not necessarily there was open conflict going on, but not necessarily directed at Americans. But it was getting very tense. We were getting very tense, and we were a little unsure of the intentions of the Somalis, and especially in this part of the country, we weren't particularly familiar with it. So we anchored off a couple hundred yards off the beach one night with the instructions for the local villagers to keep their vessels on the beach all night, nothing in the water. And overnight on watch was myself and my squad leader, who's a sergeant. And we were in the wheelhouse of the boat, and we were up all night, and you know, you get to talking and this and that. We didn't expect any trouble, and all of a sudden, out the window was the mast of this boat, and they approached the vessel, and we didn't hear them. And all of a sudden, there they were, and they were right next to us, and we thought that they were coming at us. And both of us had our rifles up and pressure on the trigger, and seconds away from committing this horrible act, which would have been shooting this completely very misguided but very innocent person. And it was a horrible, horrible experience, realizing how close we had come to killing this this man, who really was not threatening us in any way. He just was coming out to, you know, say hi.
Was this the kind of thing that haunted you when you were in the military, the fact that you came that close? Or in the future, you could accidentally kill somebody who was innocent.
Yeah, because I hadn't given it much thought before that incident. I really hadn't, you know. And then all of a sudden, you know, it was a thing. It was like, oh my God, I almost killed somebody, you know.
How come you didn't? I mean, what prevented you from pulling the trigger?
It's a very interesting thing. I don't know. I mean, we were almost within rights to do it. Not quite, but almost.
Because the person in the boat was violating
because
an order.
Because the order had been given to the villagers to, mm-hmm. you know, et cetera. It was really just chance. I mean, we were both there. I mean, I can't speak for John, the guy who was with me, but I know that there was a certain amount of pounds of pressure on the trigger, and this is one of the things that so haunted me and led me to the writing of this book, and I am... This is such a common thing, and I think becoming more and more common with modern deployments. I mean, I think it's always the case with war, and civilians don't see that. You see this, the good guys shoot the bad guys, and the bad guys die. Sometimes the bad guys shoot the good guys, and that's sad, and then they die. But what you don't see when you're watching the movie is all the other people on the sidelines who are also getting shot, you know, by accident or on purpose. And as we're getting more and more of these urban conflicts and these other things, it's a much larger thing.
So after this incident in which you nearly but didn't shoot someone who was actually innocent, and who wasn't threatening you, did you feel like I don't have the stomach to do this anymore? I mean, what?
No, it wasn't that. I mean, I stayed in. I mean, uh-huh. You know, I was in Somalia and I went on to go to Haiti and I almost reenlisted. So it wasn't so much the stomach as it was, I am very aware that now that these things can happen to me and I need to be on my guard. When we went into Haiti, we went in the first wave. And at the time, we thought we were invading the country. We fully expected combat. when we went into Port-au-Prince that morning. And as we know, it turned out differently. But the going in was very tense. And that's what I had in my head, was remembering that night. And it wasn't that I lost my stomach for it. I really wanted to go to Haiti. It was, Bauman, watch what you're doing. Stay on your toes, you know.
My guest is Christian Bauman. His new novel is called The Ice Beneath You. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Christian Bauman, and he's just completed his first novel. It's called The Ice Beneath You. It's based on his experiences serving in the military in Somalia in the early 90s. What was it like for you the night before you went to Haiti when you were expecting conflict?
It was very scary. That was a very scary situation. It was funny. It was so the reverse of Somalia. We went into Somalia. The first wave of troops went into Somalia. We went in thinking that there was going to be no conflict. And then it ended up, that whole thing ended up going just completely, you know, out of control. Haiti was the exact opposite. You know, Haiti ended up being this fairly nonviolent deployment. But the beginning was very, very tense. And it wasn't until the very last second that Cedrus agreed to stand down and let the troops come in. And even then, from the ground soldiers' point of view, we didn't trust that. I mean, we knew, I think, a couple of hours before we got to the port that he had agreed that Carter had done what he needed to do. I always say, Jimmy Carter saved my life. Thank you, Jimmy. So we knew that had happened, that Cedrus was gonna back away, but we didn't trust that. And we didn't trust that everybody knew that. So it was still very tense. It was very scary. And we were going right into the middle of the port in Port-au-Prince is right in the middle of town. When you talk about urban conflict, you know, urban warfare. I mean, that's what that would have been right there.
There's a sentence in your novel that I think describes the feelings that you're expressing that happened to you on that day that boat came into sight and you weren't sure whether you should fire or not. Your character says, "I am an American fighting man and I have no idea what the hell I'm shooting at."
Yes, or why. Yeah. Yeah, that's... Somalia was a case study in that, you know. I mean, here we were. I think it was a different thing by the time when you were leading up to the Battle of Mogadishu. It was a different scenario. You had the Rangers and Task Force Ranger, and these guys were sent in to fight. You know, they were sent in for a mission. By that point, there was a combat mission. When we were there, it was not that, and what it was this slow build of, oh, someone's shooting at us, and oh, I'm not sure why, and now we're shooting back, but I'm not exactly what we're shooting at or why they're shooting at us, and just this very large confusion about what the larger mission was, who these people were, whether it was the Somali people as a whole or different factions who felt different ways. It was very, very confusing from the private's point of view.
Did you know any, like, Somalia history? Did you have a sense of what had gone on recently in the country?
No, I didn't. And and as privates go, I considered myself kind of worldly. I mean, I had lived in India for a year as a kid, and I mean, I knew my way around a map. And Somalia was a blank page even to me. So yeah, no, it was very, you know, I knew a little bit. We knew that there had been a war with Ethiopia before, and that was about it.
What does the Army do in an attempt to prepare you for the culture that you're going to see and for the conflict that you're going to be a part of?
In that case, nothing. Nothing.
Mistake, do you think? I mean, would it be better to know that, or is it irrelevant once you're assigned to your duties?
I don't think it's irrelevant. I don't see how it could be irrelevant. I mean, I think that there is a certain amount of truth, and you only need to know so much. And knowing too much could actually impede your job as a soldier. But I think you have to know a certain amount. You have to know who these people are. Again, you're in these situations, especially with this face-to-face, no-front-line kind of situation we keep running into.
where you're looking at not at necessarily always at people in uniform. You're looking at people in civilian clothing and having to make a decision of whether or not you're going to shoot them. So you ought to have a good idea of who these people are. And I don't feel that the Army always does a good job of letting you know that.
A lot of people who have been in the military say that, you know, some of the time you're under fire and it's terrifying, the adrenaline's pumping. There's a lot of periods of boredom.
Yeah.
And your character, you know, in the novel, your character talks about these long, like, three-day shifts, and he's always reminded that his drill sergeant used to say, "He who sleeps dies." What did you do to try to keep awake and alert during long, uneventful shifts?
You know, it's interesting. I never really had a problem with it. There was this part of me, even when things were weird, I wanted to be there. I really did. It might just be my personality, but I wanted to see what was going on. So I just felt like I was always awake, and I didn't particularly have a problem with that. And I had a drink that I concocted to help me out of this. Actually, everyone in my squad had this drink. Every morning if we had slept, we would wake up. We had our bottled water, and we would throw in 3 packs of Taster's Choice into this cold water, 2 aspirin and 3 vitamin, shake, mix, and drink. And that pretty much fueled us through the day. I would get tired. In my point of view, it was like I'm on the deck of this mic boat in a foreign country, and I'm not sure what's going on. I had no trouble staying awake. I was either nervous or I was curious, and both of those things are better than caffeine.
Christian Baumann is the author of the new novel, The Ice Beneath You. He'll be back in the second half of the show. Baumann is also a songwriter and singer. Here's an original song called Blues for Willie Parker about one of his roommates in the barracks. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
You got this shotgun, shaking hands with my back. I got a cold beer in my hot Cadillac. You got a warrant? Give me some reason to move. I got a headache, I got a bad attitude. How's that for an answer, chief of mine? Talking too fast, you ain't the first cop in my life. Well, yeah, won't be the last. I know, but I've never been taught how the price of living young is growing old. And now the price of stepping out is stepping in. Sing the fire to the pen again. My name is Willie. That's Mr. Parker.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of The Wisdom of Menopause, Creating Physical and Emotional Health and Healing During the Change by Dr. Christiane Northrup. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
It seems like every network has its own reality show. Coming up, TV critic David Bianculli considers why. Ken Tucker reviews Cody Chestnut's new CD, The Headphone Masterpiece. And we continue our conversation with Christian Baumann, author of The Ice Beneath You, his autobiographical novel about a young soldier. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Christian Bauman. His new novel, The Ice Beneath You, is based on his experiences enlisting in the Army after the Gulf War, then doing tours of duty in Somalia and Haiti. The Ice Beneath You is Bauman's first book. He's also worked as a cook, painter, clerk, editor, and performer. One of the things you did when you got out of the Army was play folk music and tour, record a little bit. Were your songs influenced by your experiences in the Army?
A lot of them were. Some of them were drawn exactly from it, exactly from those experiences, and others were just influenced in one way or another. I had, before I was in the Army, I used to hang out in, I would take the bus in once a week, the bus or driver take the train into Greenwich Village from New Jersey, and hang out with this group of songwriters. It was a weekly thing at the apartment of Jack Hardy. And that little meeting has kind of become legendary in its own right. That's, you know, John Gorka and Suzanne Vega and Christine Lavin and folks like that came out of that songwriters group. And at the time that I was there, some of them were still around. Richard Schindel was going there a lot. Richard Julian, Wendy Beckerman, Linda Scher, people of that age. And so that's when I started writing songs, and I was hanging out with these people. The thing was, is while I was in Somalia, I started sending lyrics back. So instead of writing letters to people or whatever soldiers usually do, I was writing lyrics about what I was seeing in country and then sending them home to New York to the Songwriters Exchange, which is what it was called, which is Jack's apartment. And some of them were bad and some of them were whatever. Some of them were good. There's actually a fast folk recording somewhere of Jack singing a song called Kismayo. At the bottom line, I always found it to be a funny juxtaposition of me, you know, this young kid in Somalia and sending this stuff back to Greenwich Village where it gets kind of turned into a functioning folk song, you know, about what's going on in the world.
You know, it's funny, you are a folk singer and songwriter in addition to now being a novelist. And I think we associate folk singers with, like, protest music, anti-war music, and I mean, you enlisted and served, and we're glad to be serving. I mean, that was the right thing for you at that time. So you're kind of not from that, you know, more predictable.
Well, you have to. That's not such an easy. You have to see where I come from, mm-hmm. with folk and what my influences are. Mm-hmm. Big fan of 60s folk, but mm-hmm. that's not where folks started, and that's not where my heroes are. Mm-hmm. My biggest hero is Woody Guthrie, and, you know, Pete Seeger, and people like that. And you know, is there some protest there? You bet. But you know, Woody enlisted. You know, it's what's going on at the time, you know, and what you need to do to get by in your life as well. You know, there's lots of contradictions out there.
What are some of the things you did to make a living after you got out of the military?
I did a lot. I did more before I was in the military. You know, I've worked as a painter, as a contractor. I've worked as a cook. I've worked as an editor. My problem has always been, both professionally and most frustrating of all artistically, is that my education stopped when I was 17. Formal education stopped when I was 17. It's very, very difficult to get anybody to take you seriously when your education stopped at the age of 17. And it doesn't matter how smart or articulate you might be anyway. So it was always hard for me to find some good way to support my family. It was certainly hard for me to ever be taken seriously as a writer. Most people who have novels published have an MFA and a nice bachelor's degree and stuff. It's very, very difficult in New York to get anyone to pay any attention to you without a college degree.
Your new novel is based on your experiences in the Army while you were in Somalia in the early 90s. Now we're facing war with Iraq. Is there a part of you that wishes you were in the military now and would it be serving your country in this war?
That's one of those that's yes and no. I mean, the easy answer is no. did what I did, and I'm out and don't need to do that again. But I think if you've been a soldier, there's that. Yeah, you know, there's no question. When I see them going out, when I see them deploying, you get that thing of, geez, I ought to be there. It's less now. It was very difficult right after I got out when guys I had served with were still in and were deploying places. That was very, very difficult. Because you really felt that you really ought to be there, you know. I felt that way anyway. Without me, they're sunk, you know. And it's this very silly thing, but you feel that way. You know, the guys are going, and I got to go too. I feel less that way now, but you do. I feel that when you watch the news and see them going out, you think, you know, I ought to get into shape. but really, no, I don't ever need to do that again.
My guest is Christian Baumann. His new novel is called The Ice Beneath You. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Christian Baumann. His new novel, The Ice Beneath You, is based on his experiences enlisting in the Army after the Gulf War, then doing tours of duty in Somalia and Haiti. Christian, you're a writer. You're very reflective. It seems to me you're pretty introspective also. I think a lot of people in the military aren't necessarily that introspective, and introspection isn't necessarily a really good trait to have when you're in the military, because the more introspective you are, the more doubts you're likely to have as you think something through and think it through again, the more ambiguity you might see. And I don't know that the military is a great place to be caught up in ambiguity and fear. Also, the more you think something through, the more you see the possibilities for getting hurt. You don't want to be thinking about that a lot either. So I'm wondering if your introspection and your imagination ever got in the way in the military?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I thought way too much. It is not introspection is probably not a great trait for a soldier. A certain amount of it, I think, is necessary. Otherwise, you're a robot.
Right.
You know, nobody wants a robot with a rifle in their hand. You know, but you don't want to have to think about it too much. You don't, this is the job, this is the mission, this is what I do, and you don't question it. And that's important. It's very important that you have that. So if you're thinking too hard, you can lose that, and you do start questioning. You don't want to think about the bigger picture. You don't want to think about your commander in chief and what you feel about him. You know, those things are not important. So I think it can be difficult for a writer to be, you know, in the military, or if you have the personality of a writer, because you are looking and you are thinking, and maybe you're looking too hard and thinking too hard. And I felt that way about myself while I was in. I didn't know what direction I was going with my writing when I joined. I didn't know where I was going to go. I didn't know whether it was a lyricist or a novelist or whatever. I just knew that I wrote, and that's what I wanted to do. And from the day I joined, I viewed myself as a writer in the Army, and I watched things in that way, and I based very much on the model, although maybe unintentional with him. Of I always felt this thing with very specifically like Hemingway in Italy, in this being in this situation, this not a frontline combat job. He was an ambulance driver. I had a very similar kind of job when I was in the Army. It was not this frontline combat, all-encompassing thing. Yet at the same time, by the nature of the job I did, you're not exactly in the rear echelon either. You mm-hmm. see the front line. So it's this observer role and just wanting to be the witness to the event. And I knew that going in. I knew that I wanted there to be an event, and that I wanted to be at the event and to be witness to the event. And And I got it, and I got it twice. But what you said is very interesting because it's very true. In the same time, I had a job to do, and my job was not being a writer. My job was being a soldier. And if I thought too much, I was not going to be a very good soldier.
So it sounds like there were times when you think that reflection did get in the way.
There were times I think reflection could have gotten in the way. I think I managed to get through.
Can you describe one of those times?
I had difficulty in Haiti. Somalia was a little different because by the nature of what we did, we were frequently very removed from the civilian population. We had some interaction. We would drive through the city, and on the boats, I certainly saw people. We would go to to a village, but for the most part, we were very separate from the Somali population. My group of guys was anyway. In Haiti, there were times where it was kind of much more in your face. I remember going to Jacmel, which is this southern town in Haiti, and we had a couple of days there with not much to do, and there was no greater American military presence there at the time. So we kind of just wandered and really had some very real interaction with the people. And I remember having a difficult time sometimes trying to grasp what it was we were doing there, why we were there, and how the mission was being executed. And I very distinctly remember thinking, you better stop thinking about this or you're going to be in trouble.
One of the things that imagination can lead to is imagining worst outcomes, imagining getting hurt, imagining getting killed, imagining the pain. And that's something you really shouldn't be thinking about a lot if you're in the military. I'm wondering if that dark side of the imagination ever kept you awake at night or got in your way of a functioning in the way you need to function as a soldier.
No, not in that way. I mean, I think I do have a very vivid imagination and a very vivid imagination about pain. I think that you have to make a decision. You're either going to just block that out or you're not, mm-hmm. Because otherwise there's no way to function. I remember when I left the Mike boats and went on the ship for my last year and a half in the Army, I remember, for instance, sailing to Haiti or sailing wherever we were sailing. I have in my imagination, I've got this thing where you stand on the rail and you wonder about jumping in and nobody would find me and I would drown and how would that feel? I mean, these very morbid, sick, the whole people stand on a bridge and, feel the urge to jump thing. I used to get that and I would think the thing through and stuff like that. And that's no good. But you could have a thing where I know that you could think and imagine what would it be like to step on a Claymore mine? What would it be like to get shot in this place or this place or this place? How would that feel? And you just have to cut that off because I think or at least that's what I did. I mean, I just didn't go down that road. I didn't think about it because I knew I had a very vivid imagination, and if I started down that road, I would be useless.
And has that part of your imagination opened up again because now you're writing and you have to imagine that kind of thing?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
Christian Baumann, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, the pleasure is all mine, Terry. Thank you very much.
Christian Baumann is the author of the new novel, The Ice Beneath You. If you watch a lot of TV, this week may leave you wondering, why are there so many reality shows on TV, and why are so many of them so popular? TV critic David Bianculli says there are reasons why the genre began and continues to grow that generally are overlooked.
Consider one particular block of primetime in the middle of this week. On CBS, there's the last half hour of the live, recently revived talent contest Star Search. On Fox, there's the first half hour of the recently returned talent contest American Idol. And on ABC, there's the first half hour of an expanded edition of that voyeuristic dating contest, The Bachelorette. Why are there so many of these? And why are almost all of them attracting enough viewers to succeed? The obvious answer is that all of these shows exist because of the huge popularity of Survivor, which in turn existed because of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. Another big factor is that reality shows are a lot cheaper to produce than scripted comedies and dramas, and many more of them catch on quickly. But the real reason we have so much reality on TV now is because a few years ago, Hollywood was threatened with a writer's strike. It didn't happen, it was called off at the last minute, but by then, TV executives had geared up with their emergency plan B, which was to order a lot of series that didn't require writers. They were unscripted shows, reality shows. And when they showed up, viewers ate them up. So TV, as it always has done, went into overdrive trying to copy that success. Now that Joe Millionaire is a big hit for Fox, that network will continue to use the Monday time slot for other reality shows once Joe is unmasked as a thousandaire. Coming up on Fox, and I'm not kidding here, is a show where perfect strangers will agree to be married based on the votes from Fox viewers. Right now, in primetime, we have the dating shows like Joe Millionaire, The Bachelorette, and Meet My Folks. We have the real-world-type enforced cohabitation shows like The Surreal Life and High School Reunion. We have talent shows like Star Search and American Idol. And we have ultra-tacky reality specials like Man vs. Beast and ultra-tacky competitions like Fear Factor. One sociological explanation for the success of these shows is that they all do symbolically what High School Reunion does literally. They throw us back into those unforgettable and Darwinistic days of high school. When those guys are standing there waiting to get a rose from the Bachelorette, or those women are waiting to get a necklace from Joe Millionaire, they're standing there just like at one time or another we all stood there in gym class while teams were being chosen. Outside, they're saying nothing. Inside, they're all screaming, "Pick me! Pick me!" The shows themselves are doing the same thing, and viewers are picking a lot of them. These aren't long-term romances, though. These are quick flings. One of the reasons it's so easy to get involved in The Bachelorette or Joe Millionaire is because viewers know up front they're not risking any long-term emotional commitment or time investment. From the time we first meet Joe Millionaire until the time we watch the show's duplicitous payoff, little more than a month will have passed. And when we listen along with the judges during the first open auditions for American Idol, we know the winner of that contest will be revealed in a mere 4 months. Meanwhile, we get to look for possible winners and hear some definite losers.
How are you?
Pretty good.
Okay,
so I'm so happy to meet you, Simon.
What, just me?
I'm psyched. And Paula and Randy.
But who would you rather meet?
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, God. You're in trouble.
I was telling everybody the whole reason I, like, auditioned and got a bracelet was so I could meet you and audition for you. So you got me to this point. You're thinking about you.
Oh, my God.
What are you going to sing?
Pink, Don't Let Me Get Me.
Are you a good singer?
Yes, I'm great. I'm not dreadful. I'm not horrible. Okay, ready?
Right, I'm ready.
Okay. I never win first place. I don't support the team. Can't take direction and my socks are never clean. Wait, I know the whole song. Wait, sorry, I'm sorry.
I'm going to stop you there, okay. Cynthia. Because you're right, that wasn't dreadful and it wasn't horrible. It was absolutely ghastly.
I know, I'm
terrible.
Sorry. Wait, can I redo it?
There's no point. You can't sing.
Wait, one more time, please.
Cynthia, when really deep down inside, when you ask yourself, am I really a good singer? Would you really, in your soul, think that you are?
I do. I think I have talent. But you really think it's not because I forgot the words or anything? It's really you don't think
that was
I can
the
sing?
Only good part of your audition.
You can't sing.
I'm serious. Randy, yes or no to the next round?
Definitely, definitely not.
Paula?
I'm sorry, Cynthia, no.
Cynthia, it's a no.
Oh.
No.
Yeah?
No, yeah.
No.
Is really that bad?
Worse than you think.
Can I do it one more time?
No,
listen to me. There's only so much punishment a human being can take.
No, I can take a lot more.
No, I can't.
No,
I can't.
Not you, us.
Cynthia, you are
I can't
funny.
Take any more.
Please,
thank
one
you,
more time.
Cynthia. No. Thank you.
Nice to meet thank you.
Nice to meet you anyway, Cynthia. Bye.
Likewise.
Compared to a regular weekly series like NYPD Blue, which presents an ongoing storyline stretching over more than 20 episodes in 9 months, 1 month, even 4 months, is nothing. It's a summer beach book, not War and Peace. For the networks, short orders of such quick-hit ideas make perfect sense. If they tank, the networks have risked little. If they hit fast, as The Bachelor did, well, there's always a follow-up to be generated. The market won't be oversaturated until viewers start rejecting these shows wholesale, and that's not happening yet. The ease of viewing and the lack of commitment required is no small part of it. Look at what HBO has managed to do Sunday nights at 9, with The Sopranos, Sex and the City, 6 Feet Under, and now Oz rotating in the same time slot. That's less than an evening of primetime in total, and they're not even shown at the same time. Yet HBO has built the reputation using this 1 hour of Sunday viewing as the best in the business. Part of that is that viewers are seeing less and enjoying it more. Having only 13 episodes of The Sopranos at a time and waiting endlessly for the next batch apparently adds to the mystique. Fox is taking HBO's model and trying to build Mondays at 9 as its own reality hour franchise spot. Watch this space, Fox is saying. And for now, it appears, people will.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Coming up, Kentucky reviews Cody Chestnut's new CD, The Headphone Masterpiece. This is Fresh Air. Cody Chestnut is a 33-year-old from Atlanta, relocated to the West Coast, whose 23-song, boldly titled album, The Headphone Masterpiece, has arrived with a lot of publicity for its mixture of hip-hop and 60s-style guitar rock. Is Chestnut hype or the real thing? Rock critic Ken Tucker says maybe a little bit of both.
Cody Chestnut, that's Chestnut without a T in the middle, and anyway, he was born Antonius Thomas, is one cool piece of work. Influenced by Sly Stone, Prince, The Beatles, and Beck, Chestnut shares with all those artists eccentricity, a witty arrogance, as well as a treacly ballad called Michelle. When he's at his loosest and most charming, he composes a funky acoustic ballad about still living at home with his mom, tossing in silly joke lines like, I drop it like a bomb, my pickle and my charm. He tweaks cultural cliches by asserting that all he wants is sex, religion, a new Cadillac, and a winning lotto ticket.
Yes, I'm a mama's boy. Girls like to think I'm spoiled, 'cause I'm wanting all the time. I like to make it mine. I drop it like a bomb, my pickle and my charm. Yes, it's me, if you're guessing who. I'm back again in another line, just to see what's on my mind. I do it all the time. I never bite my tongue. I speak it when it comes. All I want is give me some religion, a brand new Cadillac, and a winning lotto ticket. I don't want no pretty city boys in makeup showing me the goodies when I don't want.
At his best, Cody Chestnut writes irresistibly sexy rock songs, sung in a falsetto croon that draws you into his woozy atmosphere of lewd, loose fun. This song, called The Seed, is so good, another better-known act, The Roots, has already covered it on its latest release.
I don't ask for much these days, and I don't sit and whine if I don't get my way. I only wanna fertilize another behind my lover's back. Sit and watch it grow, standing where I'm at. Fertilize another behind my lover's back, and I'm keeping my secrets mine.
I said that's what Cody Chestnut does at his best. At his worst, Chestnut is self-indulgent, sloppy, and more than a little mean, throwing out insults at the women he claims support him. He He starts and stops half-developed melodies or lays down sappy love songs that don't sound convincing for the few seconds he maintains interest in them. He's also got a doper's sense of humor on tunes like Smoke and Love that would make Cheech and Chong come out of retirement if they thought they could get Chestnut's press attention. His music does sound good on headphones, but it's no sustained masterpiece.
She's still here, I'm thinking it over, because I can't. She stays closer to my head. She's the best I've had, she says to me. She hangs around for no reason. I think the seasons keep her near me. If she's gonna stay the way I feel now, ain't gonna be the mood I'm in forever. But I'll keep her while I think it over.
No doubt about it, Cody Chestnut is a conundrum. A prodigiously talented musician, this sprawling collection is largely self-recorded, who's also a bit too obsessed with his ego and his sexual organ for the good of his brain, which teems with the whole history of rock, as well as fantasies that sound borrowed from old R. Crumb underground comics. He's a horny pothead with a penchant for both misogyny and melodrama. In My Women, My Guitars, he asserts, I've been living hard, my breakdown is on the way. Snap out of it, Cody. Move out of Mama's house, get some male buddies, lay off the weed, and your next masterpiece may really live up to the boasting that makes you so lovable and so exasperating.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed the headphone masterpiece by Cody Chestnut.
Check. One, two, check. Get in it. Yeah, you. Come on, get in. It's all right. Come on, get in. I don't have time for sex and movies. I don't have time, hurry up, give it to me. I don't have time to change my mind. What a day is gonna be for you and me, yeah, when I find time. I don't have time for apologies and puppies.
Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
You and me, when I find time to be your shoulder, I don't have time for growing older. And it's so sad, it's too bad. I only
support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Harcourt, publisher of For Spacious Skies, The Uncommon Journey of a Mercury Astronaut by Scott Carpenter, one of the seven original Right Stuff astronauts and a member of the Aurora 7 space crew. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the New Peace Movement. We talk with a spokesperson from the controversial group The Answer Coalition, which sponsored Saturday's demonstration in Washington. And we hear from Todd Gitlin, who was a leader of the peace movement in the 60s, and Bob Edgar, head of the National Council of Churches. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.